How does COVID-19 affect people with cancer?
Best coronary interventions in people with heart attacks and shock.
A new targeted agent for some types of thyroid and lung cancers.
And remdesivir in people with moderate COVID infection. Helpful or not?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we start with the COVID ones first, and then we can move on to the ones that are not COVID. This week we have 50-50. The first one I'd like to talk about is the one that's in Lancet Oncology. It's taking a look at COVID-19 and how does that impact on people with various types of cancer. And their a priori hypothesis, and I think many of us would have thought this also, is that folks who have cancer probably are at higher likelihood of having more severe disease and poorer outcomes. So in the UK, they did a registry that's called the UK Coronavirus Cancer Monitoring Project. In this study, they looked between March 18th and May 8th. They had adult patients with cancer enrolled in this, and then they also had a parallel non-COVID UK cancer control population. 319 of their 1,044 patients in this cohort died, and 92.5% of those had a cause of death recorded as due to COVID-19. So the numbers compress, of course, and when they take a look at specific types of cancers, they find that it's the patients with leukemia who showed a significantly increased case fatality rate. They corrected, of course, for age and sex, and those hematologic malignancies, especially among those who had recently had chemotherapy, had an increased risk of death relative to COVID-19 admission.
Obviously, there are a number of risk factors for having severe disease and death: age, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, lung disease, kidney disease. And people have assumed that cancer also increased your risk of having severe or life-threatening COVID infection. This study allowed the investigators to look at all types of cancers. And what they found particularly was that the presence of a solid tumor cancer, something like a kidney cancer or GI cancer, or even lung cancer, did not increase the risk of having severe COVID infection or dying from COVID infection. It was just the hematologic malignancies that you mentioned. Now, what this allows them to do is to have an individualized risk categorization for each of the patients. So when you're taking care of patients with lung cancer, do you have to be more or less concerned and therefore change your chemotherapy? People have shortened radiotherapy, they've switched from IV to oral chemotherapy regimens, and they've also modified immunotherapy. And it suggests that, in fact, in people with solid tumors, that's probably not necessary.
So I think all of this is good news because, of course, people have been extremely reluctant to come to medical centers and continue treatment because they've been concerned about COVID-19. And as we've noted before, I feel substantially safer in the hospital than I feel anywhere else in town. So that concern, at least, is something I would probably put to rest. I think one thing that was somewhat disappointing about this study and that I would like to see confirmed is the numbers. Because as we've talked about before, when you start to parse those into the various types of malignancies, I'd sure like to see much bigger numbers so that I could feel more comfortable with the outcomes.
Yeah, but the individual numbers of pancreatic cancer and prostate cancer and lung cancer were all small. But again, they were able to take large groups, solid tumors versus hematologic malignancies like leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma. And those large categories, they were able to determine that it was the latter that had the increased risk. I agree, but these are the largest numbers we have to date.
Let's talk about your COVID one. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association. How early should we be using remdesivir? That's what I'll call it.
Even should we at all? Now you say, well, of course we should be. We've already had those studies and proven that. Well, the studies that showed that remdesivir were helpful were those that had severe COVID infection. They were hospitalized and they had a decrease in their blood oxygen content, hypoxia or hypoxemia. In a large trial of over 1,000 people sponsored by the NIH, it showed that remdesivir, if done early, can actually decrease the hospital stay by 4 days, from 15 days to 11 days, but there was no change in mortality. Well, that's the severe COVID infection. What about those that have moderate COVID infection? There were about 600 individuals. You have evidence of COVID infection. You have pulmonary infiltrates. They can see it on your lungs, but you don't require oxygen. Those 600 people got randomized to either have 5 days of remdesivir, 10 days of remdesivir, or just standard care. Those that received 10 days versus those that received standard care, their outcome was essentially the same. Those that received 5 days of remdesivir appeared to do a little bit better, but the clinical significance of it really isn't very clear because they use what's called an ordinal scale that range from everything from did the patient need hospitalization to were they dead. Each of those things wasn't similarly affected by remdesivir, and some are more significant than others. For example, dying is a much more significant event than going to be hospitalized or needing to be put on nasal oxygen. The authors were really kind of muted. They said, well, it looks like it could be beneficial, but clinical significance, really not very evident.
And it's kind of expensive. So putting people on that stuff, if they don't really need it, doesn't make any sense to me. Remind me again about the side effect profile.
Relatively minor side effects. Now, it's interesting because only about 3/4 of the individual actually completed the 5-day course. Only about 40% completed the 10-day course because they left the hospital earlier, which made it even a little bit more complicated. I think that the studies show for people with severe infection, it can shorten your hospital stay. But in those with moderate infection, I'd say the jury's still out.
Leaving our COVID things then, and let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, back to cancer. A new targeted agent called selpercatinib, which takes aim at specific mutations that are called RET, that's capital R-E-T, altered cancers. There are two studies that are in here, one taking a look at thyroid cancers and the other taking a look at non-small cell lung cancers. It turns out that with regard to the thyroid cancers, more than 50% of sporadic medullary thyroid cancers have this particular RET mutation and 10 to 20% of papillary thyroid cancers. Much smaller percentages of non-small cell lung cancers in the second study, but also colorectal, breast, and other cancers. This particular mutation generates docking sites for downstream signaling adapters, and that activates multiple key cancer effectors. So that's how this thing works. And when you take a look overall among a group of diverse cancers, these aberrations have been identified in approximately 2% of the cases of cancer. In the thyroid cancers, they had 55 patients with the medullary thyroid cancer previously treated. 69% had a response to the agent with 82% progression-free survival at 1 year. Among 88 patients who had the same mutation in medullary thyroid cancer not previously treated, only 73%, which I think is a little curious, had a response to selpercatinib, while 92% had progression-free survival at 1 year. And finally, in 15 of 19 patients with previously treated RET fusion-positive thyroid cancer, 79% had a response. With regard to non-small cell lung cancer, they had 105 patients with this mutation previously been treated with platinum-based chemotherapy, 64% response, and 39 previously untreated patients, 85% had a response. And finally, in 10 of 11 patients with central nervous system metastasis, had an intracranial response to the agent. So this looks like a valuable addition for that 2% of total cancers that express this particular mutation, and suggests to me that something we've asserted many times about cancer, that clinically we call it cancer, but actually if we take a look at really what this disease is, it's a multitude of different diseases.
Elizabeth, and I'm glad you brought that point out, because this therapy was effective in lung cancer and thyroid cancer. And you say, well, those are two different organs, but the mechanism for the growth of the cancer was the same in both these types of cancers. As you mentioned, it's a RET protein. That RET protein typically signals growth of cells. And when it mutates or fuses, there's uncontrolled growth of these cells. And that's what causes cancer. So what we're moving from is an organ-specific therapy to the molecular mechanisms behind it. So we can get really specific targeted therapies. And this particular RET therapy was effective and it was durable. And importantly, the side effects were really minimal. Only 2 to 3% of individuals that were taking the medication had to stop it because of side effects. It's one of several different targeted therapies that's now available.
Right. I guess one of my concerns is A, the expense of developing these targeted therapies and getting them to market, and B, the fact that overall 2% of cancers manifest this particular mutation. So does that mean we're going to peck away at all of these different mutations in order to develop that entire armamentarium of targeted agents that are going to help everybody with cancer?
That's a great question. I mean, I can foresee a time where look at those individual pathways that we know. And although this one may account for less than 2% of cancers, another one may be 5%, another one be 4% or 3%. So in toto, what you'll be able to do is identify the pathways that are activated in a particular cancer and have specific therapies towards that. So I think that's the future. It's targeted therapy towards the molecular mechanism, not targeted towards the organ.
Well, I'm just going to say that what I'm hoping for the future is that we're going to develop blood tests that are specific for this, be able to catch the things super early before they even start to manifest as any particular tumor type. Let's turn to your final one in JAMA Internal Medicine.
And Elizabeth, we're going to talk about individuals who have heart attacks and then after that, or as a result of that, have shock. And their mortality has been very high as 50%. Now, we know that when someone's having a heart attack, if you open their artery up, restore blood flow, you improve their overall outcome. But 70 to 80% of these people that have heart attacks and shock have more than one blood vessel involved. Only one has the clot that's caused the acute heart attack, but there are other blood vessels with blockages or stenosis. So the question is, when you're taking pictures and you identify that, do you just open the one artery or should you open all the arteries to improve overall outcome? And that's what this study addressed. Do we do just the culprit vessel or do all vessels? To do this, this is a follow-up on a randomized controlled trial. Now, you say, well, why would you want to do this after a randomized controlled trial that showed that only doing the culprit vessel was the best way to do it? Well, because it's a very selected population, and sometimes it's not a real-world experience. To address whether this applies in the real world, they used results from the cath PCI registry. That's a registry of everybody that has a cardiac catheterization. There were over 64,000 patients at over 1,600 hospitals that had a heart attack and shock. Some of those individuals had all the blood vessels open, about a third of them did, and about two-thirds just had that single blood vessel open. Doing the single blood vessel ended up with a better outcome. If you open all blood vessels, you had a higher risk of dying and a higher risk of having complications as a result of the procedure as well.
A couple other things that they mentioned in this study. One is that when you only have the culprit vessel done, you were at higher risk for subsequent requiring additional revascularization or readmission for heart failure down the road.
And you may need to have additional procedures in some patients down the road, but the thing is they live through the hospitalization. You don't kill them during the hospitalization, you'll cause complications. Here's why this is particularly important. When people present with a heart attack and don't have shock, but have multivessel disease, studies have shown they do better if you open all their blood vessels up. 10 years ago, I helped write those guidelines. We would have said, oh my goodness, when you're having an acute heart attack, don't open all the blood vessels. When you're having shock, open them all up. Now what the studies have shown is just the opposite.
That's so fascinating. And so tell me, how often do shock and MI occur together?
That's a great question. It's obviously more likely to occur in people that have either had a previous heart attack or older. I would say it's probably in the neighborhood of about 10 or 15%. Most people with acute heart attack don't have shock, but those that do, the mortality is very high.
Good information then. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.